Welcome back, listeners. My name is Jackson Vickery, and I am the host and producer of the JV Club podcast. On this episode, I spoke to sound designer and supervising sound editor Richard King and editor Jennifer Lame about their work on Oppenheimer. Could not miss this opportunity for anything. I am such massive fans of both of your works, and I am just, I'm so honored, and this, I just can't believe I'm able to chat with you guys today. So first off, I just wanted to know, obviously you guys have worked with Christopher in the past, but when did your paths first cross?
On Tenet.
Oh yeah, on Tenet. We'd never worked before together because I was came from New York and Richard's very. You're pretty LA, right?
I'm pretty LA. Yeah, I've been here for a long time. I lived in New York a long time ago, but I've been in LA longer than I've been anywhere else.
So Tenet was our first go around.
And talk about a hard project to. I mean, in the middle of.
No kidding. Yeah. Jennifer really jumped in on the deep end. Very, very complicated movie. In every way.
Big time.
And so when did you guys first hear about Oppenheimer, and when were you two first sort of brought on into the project?
Jennifer heard about it, I'm sure, long before me. I think I heard about it when it was announced in the trades, which is how Chris usually works. He keeps everything very close to the vest, and he talks to a few key people before that, like Jennifer, and then I got a call within a day or two of the announcement being made, and went in to see him shortly after. We had a met with him in the production offices, and we had a chat before he went out to shoot. And I didn't meet Jennifer until they were back, I think, for a while, and it was kind of oddly late in the process, right? I think you had been back a few weeks, maybe, or at least. Even though we were both working on the very nearby, it just didn't, didn't pan out. I was really busy and she was really busy. Mm-hmm. And I think I met you in the offices on the lot at Warner Brothers, right? That was Tenet.
No, you came in. You came into Chris's and we played you some stuff and we
were that's right. That yeah. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so what was the research process like for each of you in regards to this project?
I didn't do any research. I feel like I'm tasked with no research because I feel like I very much need to be kind of like a stand-in for the audience. So I didn't read the book, and I'm so grateful that I hadn't already read the book because I had a lot of friends who pushed it on me for a long time, and it could have been very easy that I would have read it, but luckily I hadn't. And I think knowing Chris from Tenet, I knew that he would appreciate that because it just would color my vision of, you know what I mean? Like for me, I think it's really important for Chris to make a movie for everyone, and most people that are going to see this movie haven't read the book. So I didn't read the book, and most people, I think what was so fun for me when I read the script is I hardly knew anything about him. I knew he had created the atomic bomb. I didn't know much about his history. I think the biggest thing for me is like, why don't I know more about him? Like, why didn't we learn about this in high school? And then of course I quickly realized why. I think it was great. And, I really tried to stay away from any materials while working on the movie and just focus on the movie and what I had to deal with.
A ton of research. as soon as I read the script, I read the book, and then proceeded to read every book I could find on the subject. And to me, it was just it was a window into that world that was important for me to have. And not only that, but I was incredibly curious about it and wanted to learn as much as I could. And a lot of that was just curiosity, my own curiosity, but a lot of it also, I think, or much of it informed my work in that sometimes the facts can be more interesting than anything you could make up. And I appreciated learning about hearing firsthand experiences from the participants, from the spectators, from the scientists who were at the Trinity test and who worked on the project. And it kind of deepened my sense of involvement in the film, in that I could really understand the world a little bit that they were operating in. And, you know, I think in a lot of subtle ways that informed for my work.
Mm-hmm. And upon receiving the script, I'm curious, what were some of the main things that you gleaned from it, and just things that stood out to you that might seem as challenging or need more background into, I guess you could say.
Well, I read the script and I thought, this is going to be Jennifer's really got her hands full, because it read very complicated. I loved it, but the fact that the timelines are interwoven, it really seemed to me like an editorial challenge deluxe. How it informed reading it informed my work was, I think, in a lot of intangible ways and in some tangible ways. For instance, the most of the books on Manhattan Project mentioned or quoted spectators of the test, and who were all interviewed within a day or so of the test, just to get their immediate gut reactions. And they all mentioned, obviously, the visual, the spectacular, the white light and the colors and the huge cloud, but they also mentioned sound, and often in very interesting, unusual ways. Not in a way that you would like, oh, it was just a big loud noise, but they described it in ways that I wouldn't have expected. And I found that with Dunkirk too, the way sounds were described by people who were there, if I didn't necessarily copy those ideas, I definitely utilized them. And I think it's not a bad thing to have some, for me to have some command of the facts. It just helps me to get into the story and into the kind of vibe of the movie. Mm. For instance, the way they described the sound was often, they described it as like a freight train passing, or the sound of thunder, but man-made thunder, odd sounding thunder. And
that's hard to create.
yeah. I mean, it was clear to the, it didn't sound like natural sounds, but it sounded like, because a lot of these people were, you know, miles and miles and miles away, and the sound was reverberating around the hills, around the site. And so that was great inspiration, because that's the sound of the explosion needed to be, needed to have some unique quality. It couldn't just be a chemical explosion played really loud. There had to be some unique quality to it. And the firsthand descriptions kind of gave me a window into what that might sound might be.
Mm. And so how did you tap into that, and how did you ultimately come up with that creation?
A lot of experimenting and a lot of the detonation happens within milliseconds. It's not like a chemical explosion. So I imagined that the shock wave would have a very hard attack. It would be like a brick wall hitting you if you were standing outside. And so the sound had to have it in just like an immediate, really hard attack. And I kind of imagined it like a huge door slamming. Like it just needed to have this bang, followed by a long ongoing rumble as the sound reverberated around the hills. And I just, you know, I can't really say what I used, or don't want to say, but a lot of the inspiration came from those firsthand accounts. And you know, it wasn't necessarily to make it sound exactly like it would have sounded, but to make it sound as interesting as one would expect it to sound, and as unique as one would expect it to sound.
Mm. And so, Jennifer, with that particular scene, the detonation scene, I'm curious how you went about constructing that, because it really does sort of, I mean, it's very sort of pulsing, and it's just, it doesn't let, I just remember the amount of anxiety I was having during that entire scene. So I'm curious as to how you just built and constructed such a dynamic and powerful scene like that.
Well, I think Chris and I kind of just sat down one day and did it, and all the pieces were there, him and Hoyta and Ruth actually was really instrumental in, like, you know, everything to like the tape and the all the little machinations inside the tent, and all those little details were super helpful in terms of just building that tension leading up to then the night, right? And I think that lead up to then the kickoff of the night, once we get to night and then the detonation happens, is super important. Of like, so it's like we have that preamble of like that anxiety and like, you know, just I think the nerviness of it, you know, to show all the scientists kind of like, you know, there's so many great close-ups of all of those guys. They're such incredible actors and gave so much. And for me, what's so interesting about that whole section is how insane it all was in terms of you know, when they're rolling the mattresses under the bomb and it's like in case it falls, because it's all like, you know what I mean? And just like showing those guys rolling those rolled up dirty mattresses. And then when the guy's measuring and saying like, are we going to be far enough away? And he's like, I don't know. You made the calculations. Like, are we, you know, it's like, I think that whole part really informs that second part. And then when we have that great music cue and the rain's coming and they're in the tent and then everything's going kind of wrong again, when Kisikowski runs in and he's like, the last test failed, but like, I bet you $10 it's going to work. So I think for me, what's so great about that sequence, and again, this is all in the writing and then of course in the performances, but like just the, just how precarious and everything was, and like at any moment, everything could just go to shit, you know? And then of course, you know, just working on it with Chris, like leading up to all the little moments with the button, and, you know, he's so good at all that stuff. And when I first put my assembly together, I always say like, I kind of just breezed by that section because I knew that it was going to be great. And I knew that him and Hoyta and everybody, like, I knew it was all there, and we cut it pretty quickly. And we would always go back and like refine it and make it better. And we always were like, let's put one more shot of the hand over the button and the guy's face, cause he's scared. But it was that sequence was actually quite easy to put together, because I think Chris had so like locked in on it, you know? And so for me as an editor, what was fun about that sequence is sprinkling my little thing of like, you know, just adding whatever to lift it up even more. But it was just, it was pretty amazing from like the first 3 hours we sat down and put it together, you know?
Mm. And so, I mean, speaking of challenging sequences, I'm curious for you two, what were those sort of challenges that you had to overcome in terms of those sequences?
I think probably the most challenging pieces for me were the Robert's subjective moments, because he's such an enigma, you know, throughout the film, and he was such an enigma to his friends. But there's a number of moments where we are kind of are allowed a peek inside of his head, and you know, to experience his foreboding, or to experience his, well, first experiencing his obsession with quantum particles and waves, and him becoming so engrossed in that he almost loses touch with the world that he can feel and see with his eyes, and you know, and things just start to kind of come apart, and he becomes a little bit you know, disoriented as a young man. And then later, as he's working on the project, his moments of you know, like I said, foreboding, and then his moments of just confusion and regret, and I think still grappling with, you know, post test and post dropping bomb, coming to grips with what he had done, and why he had done it and stuck with it. And I mean, that's the, to me, there remains the enigma of the man is, you know, what, how did his mind work in that sense, between those two poles of being a, you know, a pacifist, basically, to creating this weapon that he helped deliver and helped pick the targets for. So those subjective moments, the Fuller Lodge sequence where he's talking to the assembled scientists, and it's sort of this almost Fellini-esque kind of nauseating scene of jubilation, and people are also throwing up and getting drunk, and it's just a kind of a bizarre, surreal scene, and that's where his mind is. He's a little bit, you know, a little bit, I don't know. We're given a glimpse into someone who's still trying to come to grips with all of this. So I think those are the sequences for me that were the more subjective sequences, were the most challenging. Hmm. And Jen and Chris designed a lot of the Fuller Lodge scene was I gave them a lot of raw material early on and a version of the scene, and then they picked and chose what they wanted to use from the you know, all the elements, and so yeah.
I think for me, what was some of the more challenging sequences were the stuff with straws, and kind of like him explaining some stuff. Like when we first kind of pivot to him and the aide is kind of like, well, who, what, like, you know, asking him a lot of questions about what happened to Oppenheimer with the, you know, in room 2022 and who did that. And then later on when Strauss is like, maybe we should pivot and I should sit, like all those little subtleties of Strauss kind of leading the aide into thinking he's this nice, friendly guy. And then maybe he's not. I felt like all of that stuff was, to me, when I read the script, so fascinating and interesting. But I could see once we started to put the movie together that for an audience, it was quite challenging, right? Because it was a lot of, it was, some of it was like in the weeds a little bit, and not everyone knows what, like, a, like, you know, what the hearing was for. Like, you know, like, so for me, the challenge for those sequences was to make it as clear as possible and make sure that no matter what, people could kind of really understand his whole journey and follow kind of, is he a friend? Is he a foe? Is he an adversary? Is he helping him? And just really making that kind of feel like a journey. Because I feel like if people kind of lose that thread, then it's, you're going to struggle to keep them involved for the last third of the movie. And I really loved that Strauss is one of my favorite characters, and I also love Robert Downey Jr.'s performance. So I wanted people to kind of revel and love it as much as I loved it. And I feel like in order to do that, you have to make sure people really understand what he's doing, because it's complicated.
I love the way that it sort of, I mean, it can go in between genres in this 3-hour film, where it's, there's sort of the romantic drama, and then there's this sort of exhilarating drama, and then there's the courtroom drama that's going on all sort of at the same time. And you don't really lose the sort of main focus of what's going on, which is absolutely lovely and incredible feat to do in a film of that length and of that scope. Bravo again on that. But in regards to, I mean, what you take away from Oppenheimer in general, and I'll leave this up to you in terms of the way you want to answer it, but what do you take away from this film or from this character, the Oppenheimer character, not killing me, but Oppenheimer himself? And I'm just curious what you take away from him or the film that, like you said earlier, Jennifer, something that was not taught in probably many, many high schools, that you hope that this film is able to sort of capture.
Well, I love that Chris doesn't attempt to explain him. He remains an enigma, and he remains someone who really whose motives can't be really fully explained. And and I think that not to get political, but we're in much of the same territory now with in politics and government, and that there's factions. I think it's a timely film, it's a very timely film in that it, in that a lot of these dilemmas are unfamiliar to people now. And, you become an enemy of the government through no fault of your own. And in fact, he was one minute he's a war hero, and the next minute he's an enemy, he's a communist. And I think that, this will help in at least the wider public to kind of rejuvenate his legacy. And I noticed that his security clearance was posthumously renewed, I think just about the time the film came out. I think it provides a really good overview of the situation and how things went down with him, and in a way that hasn't been done before.
And Jennifer?
I think what I take away, I found him to be, I was surprised by how relatable I found him, which is why I found kind of the film so incredible. It was so fun to me that someone who was, in charge of the Manhattan Project was also like going and visiting Jean, his ex-girlfriend, in a hotel room, but also creating this, I just thought the messiness of his character was so fascinating and interesting. I also love the idea that, he dedicated himself to doing something that he thought was for good, and then they destroyed him. And I think a lot of people have that experience in life. I was saying it, how some woman wrote this amazing New York Times piece, a personal piece, about how she related more to she related to Oppenheimer as a woman, and I just feel like there's so many ways into his character where you can relate to him. But then of course there's the enigma of him where you actually don't necessarily really, he never really said what he was thinking or feeling about the bomb. But I feel like the movie, you see how he operates in the world, and you see how he relates to people and his love for Jean and how devastating that was for him. And so there's so many like human, beautiful elements of it. And then one of my other favorite things about the movie is when General Groves, Matt Damon's character, says, you know, I wouldn't have cleared any of those guys back then. And like, I love that there was this part, there was this moment in history where they gave these young scientists $1 billion to create this thing. And unfortunately it was the bomb, but like, I know there's, I think like Oliver Stone or someone is working on harnessing nuclear energy to like save us from climate change. But I just think it's such a cool idea that there was a point in history where we let scientists do this amazing thing, unfortunately for bad, but I wish that we did that today, you know? So I think it's cool to see like, we could do that at one point, maybe we could do it again when we're all like doomed for other reasons, you know? And so it's just like a cool movie to see how like these young guys did this awesome thing, but then yeah, the government destroyed them for it. So I just think there's so many amazing dichotomies from like the big to the little that I relate to on so many different levels. And I think other people did, which is why people seem to really love this film. As much as we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, final question for you two. I rarely get the opportunity to have two people from, I mean, in the same realm, but in different realms, sort of make their way into the same interview. So I'm curious what you two have taught each other. Richard, something I learned from Jennifer. Jennifer, you might have learned from Richard.
I think I learned from Jennifer really to focus on, and this carries through from Tenet too, a focus on character and story first and foremost. I can sometimes be kind of led astray by some excitement in the moment or some cool thing about that moment of the film, but she's able to see beyond that and how that works in the overall scope of the film. And so while we were mixing, I always appreciated her comments, because she she was thinking big picture, while quite often I was so involved in that sequence, in a particular sequence, that was my focus. And it was just good to have that. And I would also often like vehemently disagree in the moment. Like, there was a music cue in Tenet that I really loved, a moment, the way it worked in that moment, and you were like, no, but it doesn't work because of, you know, it didn't work for his character in that moment. And I only realized that was true later. So I guess that's the difference between the editor who has to think big picture and the sound designer who's often thinking of making strong impression in a moment, in moments, making strong snapshots. I guess that would be a way to put it.
I think for me, I mean, just getting to work with Richard, I mean, for me was such a huge deal, because obviously I knew of his work and his work with Chris and his work on other films. And I think I just, especially on Tenet, I think I really just tried to sit back during the mix and just watch, you know, the way Richard and Chris collaborate. And, you know, Chris has told me so many amazing stories about their collaboration. And I know I have a whole library of sounds of.
Really? Chris talks about me? He likes me?
And I have I have the library now of sounds that they created. They did all this crazy shit in Interstellar. And I don't know. It's just, there's so much amazing history and collaboration, and they've worked together for so long. And I think, yeah, just getting to be a part of that and witness that and learn from that. And obviously, you know, Richard's sound talent we already know that he's incredibly talented in that regard. And it's really fun to get to work with someone that just, sound on a movie is just, as an editor, I know how important it is. And the fact that I have him creating sounds from scratch on movies like this is just amazing. But yeah, I think for me, just watching their relationship and watching how they work has been a masterclass, kind of an amazing collaboration.
And Jennifer loves sound. And that's another fun thing. There's a moment in Oppenheimer where Jean's in the bathtub and her hand slides down the tub. And Jen said, why don't we hear the sound of her hand down the tub? And I thought, that's awfully subtle. But then we put it in and it was so good. It was so like, it so locked you into that shot. It was like the perfect touch.
That's nice. Do you remember that, Richard?
She's really into sound. And so it's fun to work with people who are, you know, who enjoy it and who enjoy the process.
And also know how much it elevates the scenes of the movie. You know, yeah. It's crazy. Yeah.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. This podcast was hosted and produced by yours truly, Jackson Vickery, but a very special thank you to Sterling Gavinsky for the theme music and to Carly Haney for the artwork. We will see you next time.